In Colossians 2:8, Paul warned, "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ." So I'm going to pick up where I left off, and I'm really kind of laying out things related to a corruption of consequence. We talked about the myth of equal outcomes, and that is this. They look at it and say there are unequal outcomes, therefore there must be oppression and racism. That's where it comes from. There are no other answers given, but that's a myth. One other illustration of that is in Thomas Sowell, another book by him, he's written many, Discrimination and Disparities. He deals with a Stanford study by Professor Lewis M. Terman, and he took 1,470 of the top IQ people in America, and he followed them for 50 years, a half a century. There were not equal outcomes, even among that group, the smartest in America. Two Nobel Prize winners who did not make the IQ cut, but they won Nobel Prizes. But among the IQ geniuses in the 1,470, none of them were Nobel Prize winners. Some of this group were highly successful, some were moderately successful, and they labeled 20% of them as clearly disappointments from the top IQ people in the country. Of the type IQ, you can take this and do some things, but one of them is if you take of this 20% that did not do well at all, they disappointed, the top 1% IQ people in that group, there was a 10% disparity. So that happens in there as well. And so they concluded after the study, quote, "As for factors behind differences in educational and career outcomes with Terman's group, the biggest differentiating factor was in fact family backgrounds," end quote. That's what preachers and Christians have been saying all along. But the woke, when they're in this context, they're not talking about that. That's racist to blame it on the destruction of the black family or anything else, or to even show that has a part in it. Let me give you some terms. We think we know what we're talking about when we talk to them, but you have to understand they've redefined every term. So if you're involved in this and you think you understand them, you don't, unless you understand what they mean. Diversity, for example, we think diversity is good, and it is good. And you bring together these people and this people, and if you got, you know, if you're going to build a building and you got some brick people and some floor people and you bring them all together, that's good. You got a diversity there. Diversity to them means identity diversity. Transgender, homosexual, black, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It does not mean ideological diversity. You are excluded as a Christian. I can tell you that. You don't fit if you follow the scripture. Inclusiveness. They want to be inclusive. It's a very inclusive group. What inclusive means is that's where politically correct speech comes into place. And if you say anything that would make someone there feel that you don't value their life, meaning they're transgender, homosexual, whatever it is, then you are not welcome because you are not inclusive. So Christians would not be welcome. Equity. We think it means equity and equal before the law and equal in employment, but it doesn't mean that at all. It means equal outcomes. It is Marxian. This is where reparations and all of these things come from, but also in equal outcomes, socialism. It's identity politics, that there's merit in your identity alone. I want to speak for a minute about the divisive nature of critical theory. And remember, critical race theory, intersectionality, woke, all of that is umbrellaed under this. Critical theory is different than, and this is Horkheimer, so he had traditional theory and critical theory, and traditional theory explains society, why how things are. Critical theory changes society, and it problematizes everything. So it shows all of the problems, and then it ultimately destroys it. And it's always about liberating the oppressed. And you can read the definitions. This is what it is. And if you're going to always go to a society to liberate the oppressed, so you come to America, what's the assumption? There are oppressed. How do you get rid of the oppressed and oppression and socialism and communism? Like the Soviet Union, China under Mao Zedong, Vietnam, Laos, Cuba, North Korea, India was Marxists and communists, and then they became capitalists and started taking all our jobs. That's what they do. They come over here and they work hard and they surpass us. Cambodia under Pol Pot, Khmer Rouge, socialism in Venezuela under Chavez. There are no earthly examples of communism working. In communism and socialism, in real flesh and blood history, millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people die. They're either executed by the state or they starve to death. This is a fact. So they always use a utopic vision. It doesn't exist in real life, and they compare that to real flesh and blood capitalism, and it'll always win out because it's just an idea. The new socialists say, well, we're going to do it different. When you point out these, they say, well, we're not like them. We're going to do it different. But remember, these all said they were going to do it different. Critical theory cannot unify. It cannot unify. Critical race theory cannot unify the country. It is not designed to do that. It's not in it to do that unless you arrive at a Marxian utopia. It's to get rid of everything, in fact, that people unify around. So on a national level, what you have to do is get rid of anything that unifies us as a people, and that is the flag, language, national anthem, religion, Christianity, family, history, everything. The 1619 Project that was begun by Nicole Hannah Jones, Time Magazine, that is to show that America began really in 1619, not 1776. And in 1619, it began with slavery. And thus, it is built on racism and slavery, and it is inherently evil and must be destroyed. That's the point of the 1619 Project. Now, even liberal historians, who are as liberal as the day is long, they've said it's not based on history. And Jones, the founder of it, said, I know, it's not, but we needed a myth to live by. Kind of like Alex Haley did with Quinta Kunta. So they compare it to 1776. And so what you have is if it started in 1619, you have racism and you have slavery, and that's what it's built on, so it is systemically evil. But if it began in 1776, it's built on ideas that all men are created equal. We haven't lived up to those, but you see the ideas. And by the way, there was no template for that. It had never happened anywhere in the world, and it hasn't to this day. And we've come a long ways. Critical theory seeks to liberate the oppressed, and so to do that, you have to overthrow capitalism, religion, Christianity specifically, and America. How do you do that? How does the plan work? You over-focus on that which is wrong. You problematize everything, and I could give you a million examples. We just don't have time, but everything is a problem, and you focus on that, and everything is wrong, and you exaggerate it, and you highlight it, and you repeat it over and over and over, but you do not talk about any of the good. So we recognize there are problems and faults, and I mean, Christians have been fighting this for centuries, and we still are, but we also recognize the good, and when compared to flesh and blood societies, it's the best. See? But they don't do that. They want to replace it with a Marxian socialism. So let me talk about cultural Marxism and social justice for just a moment. And they can be appropriately interchanged. They're not synonymous, but they're interchangeable. The Marxist concept is this. You find one sole thing that causes the problem, or one primary thing that causes the problem, and that's the source of all the problems. So classical Marxism, Marx did economics. But it could be oppression, oppressors of some other nature. It could be racism, and that's what they've chosen in America because of our history and where we failed. So disparities, unequal outcomes are always because of oppression or racism. There are no other reasons. I give you many other reasons in the book. Throughout the book, so that you can become conversant and say, wait a minute, could this not play a part? And you're going to know when you see these things, you're going to go, well, sure, that plays a part. Doesn't everybody know that? They do, but they ignore it because they have an agenda. There's an organization I would call to your attention. It's called fairforall.org. You ought to go just look at it. And the reason is, it's not a Christian organization. What's happening in this, what we call classic liberals who believe in free speech and everything, and they maybe want a more socialistic society or more welfare program, but they love America. They're like some of the founders. They love America. And they're fighting for free speech. And so this organization that's come together is just a mixture of people, and you can go on there and look at it, but they're against the racism and all of that as CRT is doing it. And they're against all true racism, but they're against CRT. But just listen, I just wrote down some of the people that have signed on to it, and you can sign on, and I've actually signed on to it. I sign on to anything that's recognizing these problems, by the way. Well, I guess anything. I've signed several. But this group is made up of journalists, scholars, human rights activists, musicians, actors, authors of different kinds, by the way, playwrights, entrepreneurs, economists, journalists, film producers, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, atheists, Christians. It's just a menagerie. Why? Because they see the threat that I'm talking about. They understand the threat. There's two key players in the founding of cultural Marxism, the two Horkheimer, of course, because of critical theory, but the two that you'll run across is Herbert Marcuse and Antonio Gramsci. And they were both out of the Frankfurt School, and Marcuse is a German Jew, and Gramsci is an Italian. I give a taste of them in the book, but I didn't want to overwhelm people. Again, I was trying to make it very readable and very accessible, so I do show kind of how they influence things, and I give you a Gramscian look at how, why blacks, when they become successful, all of a sudden they're rejected and hated, which is the opposite of what you would think would happen. They should be role models, see? But the opposite happens. So I look at that from a Gramscian standpoint, which I'm going to explain a little bit about to give you an insight into that. But the whole thing about the Frankfurt School and neo-Marxism, the whole thing about this is Marxism failed. Classical Marxism failed. Because they thought it was going to succeed, and when it succeeded in the Soviet Union, it would succeed in Europe and England and everywhere. So they were just waiting on it to bloom, and it didn't. So now this group comes together. Why didn't it succeed? Why did it not succeed? That's the whole issue that critical theory is about, and Gramsci and Marcuse and so forth. So Gramsci, he is, again, oftentimes, these two, I put them together because they do different things, but Gramsci is, and in a very right way, he is recognized as the founder of cultural Marxism. He thought through these things, and he understood, and he wrote about it, which became, again, accessible to us in the 70s when it's translated into English. So he did this when he was imprisoned by Mussolini. But he looked at why there was all these failures. And he believed that Marx failed in focusing on the proletariat, and he didn't involve the wealthy, and he didn't involve the powerful, and he didn't involve the intelligentsia, meaning he didn't involve culture. He ignored culture, and that's why it failed. So he believed the answer to successful Marxism and implementing communism was that you had to deal with something more than economics, and that is you had to deal with culture. He called the obstacle, what stopped Marxism from succeeding, he called it cultural hegemony. That's what he's known for, by the way, cultural hegemony. Hegemony is the power, the predominant influence, so the powerful forces, that's what that is. So he's talking about the cultural powerful forces, the people in charge of culture. That Marx didn't pay attention to that, and because he didn't, it failed. You've got to deal with this cultural hegemony. This doesn't have to do with economics. The hegemony, what makes culture strong, why couldn't he overcome this culture in Germany or England or all these places? What stopped it? It's culture. And by culture, he doesn't mean economics. He means things like the family, what we would call the nuclear biblical family. Education, the media, law, history, all of these things, they make culture, and it makes culture so unified and strong that you can't overcome it. So you have to attack the cultural hegemony. And this means that you have to attack the powerful, the people who maintain the power through law, through the media, through education, through the structure of the family, and all of these things. You have to attack that, and you have to offer, you have to deconstruct that, problematize everything with it, and you have to offer an alternative hegemony, an alternative predominant influence, which is always, anytime you hear these people, you have to quit thinking like we think and realize they're thinking and talking Marxian, and they're for communism and socialism. You have to make that transition. So Gramsci believed that culture precedes politics. So we have some, and some have tried to do that politics precedes culture, but he reversed it. And he said, if you're going to do anything, you've got to change culture, then you can change politics. So what he viewed was that the revolution was not one phase, but it's two phases. To have a successful revolution, a Marxian revolution, you have to have two phases. One is the culture. And then once that is significantly done, then you can have the political revolution and change the entire society. So the first phase is the cultural, and it focuses on weakening culture, destroying everything that holds us together and unites us. So we can think of many things, but like the nuclear family, patriotism, Christianity, religion, law, language, what it means to be a citizen, shared history, our view of capitalism. Everything has to be problematized. Every blemish is exposed, and it is repeated over and over and over and over and over, and never the good. And in all of that, and all the disparities and any problems, it's always about racism and oppression, so that people then began to believe and think and come to where they are ashamed of their country. They're ashamed of their history. They're ashamed of their culture. They're ashamed of saying that the nuclear family is best. They're ashamed of their laws. Then you're ready for the political revolution. Any of this sound familiar to you? The presence of socialism is unabashed today. Now, for young people, this is hard to grasp, but there's always been socialists in America, so I think that goes back to the beginning. But nothing like when Bernie Sanders ran for president. And in 2016, he got 46% of the Democrat delegate votes, second to Hillary. In 2020, he came in second to Biden. He is an avowed socialist. For years, he's been in Senate, but you just never heard his name, right? And then all of a sudden, he's on the scene. And he is unabashed in his socialism. What about OAC? Overnight prominence. It was meteoric. And she's an avowed socialist. 20%, they say, 20% of young millennials identify as socialist. 20%. That's a significant amount. That's just the young millennials. There were 3,000 in the Bolsheviks when the Bolshevik Revolution took place. There was only 3,000. I've told you, and I read different numbers, and I think there are a number of variables to consider, but generally speaking, somewhere between 5 and 20%, and you can have a revolution and overturn any system. I want to speak about asymmetry, and this is where I really want to spend the time. This is the most significant thing that's telling you what's happening, that you can see, and you're trying to make sense of it, and this will make sense of it for you. I want you to understand by the time you leave tonight, these things are not by this morning and tonight, and I hope you read the book, but this isn't happening random. It looks random. It looks nutty. You can't explain it, but it's explainable. It's not random. It's a plan. So asymmetry. If this wall and this wall are the same, that's symmetrical. There's a symmetry. But if this wall is different than this wall, it's asymmetrical, see? So what we're talking about is we're treating one group one way and another group another way. That's the asymmetry. We're not treating everybody equal before the law or equal in any way, okay? So I'm going to talk about Herbert Marcuse. He wrote an essay in 1965, so the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, and then he wrote this essay. It became public in 1965, and it became the game plan, as I understand it, for the riots of 1967, 68, and so forth. Notice that the riots happened after the Civil Rights Act was passed. So Marcuse wrote that. It's called Repressive Tolerance. It's about 20 pages. It's a very difficult read, and it's a long essay. But he lays it all out. But I want to give you a path, a real simple path, from Herbert Marcuse to Black Lives Matters and all of this stuff that's going on. Herbert Marcuse and Antonio Gramsci laid the foundation for what we know as cultural Marxism or neo-Marxism. Herbert Marcuse was a professor at Brandeis University, and he taught race theorist Angela Davis. Angela Davis then taught and trained, this is by their own admittance, by the way, and had a great impact on Patrice Cullors, who is one of the founders of Black Lives Matters. Alicia Garza, another co-founder of Black Lives Matters, also admits that she owes everything to Angela Davis. So Angela Davis is trained by the neo-Marxist Herbert Marcuse, and she goes out and trains the founders of Black Lives Matters. And they do, by the way, openly admit they're Marxist. Trained. They don't just say Marxist, we're trained Marxists. So I just want you to know the links are all there. So in this, and I've taken sections that hopefully will communicate what we're talking about without becoming difficult. So I want you to notice. So he says this in this paper. He lays it out. Quote, so he has, the paper is Repressive Tolerance, but he talks about liberating tolerance. He talks about tolerance, liberating tolerance, and discriminating tolerance. So this is liberating tolerance. So remember, he's a Marxist. How do we get to the communist utopia? Liberating tolerance then would mean intolerance against, is that up there? Harrison, you need to, can you put that up there? Can you see it? Okay. Because it's difficult to follow to reading it. Liberating tolerance then would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. Did you get that? Is everybody with me? We are intolerant against anybody on the right, any movement, but we tolerate all movements on the left. As to the scope of this tolerance and intolerance, it would extend to the stage of action as well as discussion and propaganda, of deed as well as word, end quote. So, on the right, if you riot and do something, you're wrong and you will be arrested and you're an insurrectionist. If you do it on the left, it's okay. On the right, we can use lethality to stop them from advancing their cause. But on the left, we don't use anything to stop them, even if they're killing people. So you're tolerant of the left, and you're intolerant of the right, and their words and actions, and he gives no limit to that. He actually talks about violence, using violence. So again, in this paper, in his last paragraph, he says, quote, part of this struggle is the fight against an ideology of tolerance. In order to get where we want to go, we have to fight the ideology of tolerance of everybody. Free speech, all of that. That's what's included. Which in reality favors and fortifies the conservation of the status quo of inequality and discrimination. For this struggle, I proposed the practice of discriminating tolerance. To be sure, this practice already presupposes the radical goal which it seeks to achieve, which is Marxism. So it's discriminating tolerance. You understand they're fighting against the idea of tolerance. Well, we're supposed to tolerate all ideas. Everybody's equal before the law. Free speech. No. they are actually against free speech. This is what he's laying out. It's discriminating. We're going to discriminate. We're going to tolerate this, and we're not going to tolerate over here because that advances the cause. Now, he argues that this is not a justified position all the time in all life and all societies and so forth. He argues that. He says, though, that the only time that this is really legitimate, that you can do this, that the left can do anything and stop the right from doing anything, is when there is a clear and present danger. And when you have that, you can do anything. And so here's his quote. He says, "The whole post-fascist period is one of clear and present danger," end quote. So since the rise and the fall of the Third Reich, we have been in a clear and present danger. Hence, it was justified in the riots of the 60s and the riots successive to that and the 2020 riots and any that come after, because we live in this clear and present danger. Therefore, the classic tolerance of free speech for everyone must give way to discriminating tolerance, where we only tolerate the left, and that will lead us to liberating tolerance. But we can accept nothing on the right, and anything we do to stop it, even if it means murdering them, it is okay. So let me give you some examples of this asymmetry. And I know it's very confusing, and I hear people all the time going, "Well, it doesn't make sense. I mean, we denounce that and this," but they don't do it. It's not by accident. It's coming right out of Marcuse. Social media. The Washington Post had an article in December the 3rd in 2020. It was entitled, "Facebook to Start Policing Anti-Black Hate Speech More Aggressively Than White Comments." Here's a quote from them. "The company is overhauling its algorithms that detect hate speech and deprioritizing hateful comments against whites, men, and Americans." They have done this. This is what we're watching on social media. This is why this is happening. It was planned. They changed the algorithms. So if you say anything about certain groups, you're removed like that. The algorithm gets you. But if it's about men or Americans, patriotism, things like that, white people, it stays up. This is not by happenstance. So they reversed years of colorblind policies, or what we would call what's race blind, meaning that if you said certain hateful things, it was deleted. It didn't matter who said it, it was just deleted. And that's changed. In interviewing the engineers who brought this about, who did the technical part, they said they had changed the company's systems to deprioritize policing contemptuous comments about whites, men, and Americans. Which ones are they policing and have become more rigid on? They call it the worst of the worst. So any slurs that are directed against blacks, Muslims, people of more than one race, the LGBTQ community, and Jews, that will be removed just like this. But if it's whites, if it's Americans, if it's male, white males, and white males are the worst of the worst of the worst. That actually has happened. That's what's been going on for the last few months. Asymmetry. We'll treat this group this way and this group this way. What about racism? When you talk about racism, and I watch people and I watch good people use racism, and if you don't define it, you can't have the conversation. Because their answer is wrong. CRT defines it one way. Racism is when the powerful people oppress the people who don't have power. So if you'll notice, it's not just about skin color, it's who has power. So in CRT, racism's like a river. It's running, it's flowing downward from the powerful. But if you're not powerful, you can't be a racist. So blacks are not racist. They can't be racist. The homosexuals cannot be oppressive towards heterosexuals and so forth. But in biblical terminology, it's colorblind. It's omnidimensional. Anybody can be a racist. And anybody can suffer racism. That's Martin Luther King, as we talked about, the colorblind. We see it, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean we do that. It means that's the aspiration. That's the idea. And that idea is not flawed, by the way. You have to ask yourself, and you're going to start seeing more and more of this, as they become more in power, what happens to racism. For example, if you go to Detroit or Atlanta, blacks have been leading those cities for years and years and years. They're in power. Ask yourself if this is power. If your group can make multi-billion dollar companies discriminate against a certain group of people that you don't like and doesn't agree with you, would you call that power? You see, this power attachment's really problematic. What about, that's an asymmetry, writing. There's an asymmetry developing in writing with black and white. When you use the word black or you use the word white, which is being pushed and being accepted, if you use the word black for black people, or, you know, just blacks, but you're referring to black people, that is to be capitalized. For white people, it is still lowercase. And Kimberly Crenshaw says the rationale for that is because blacks are more like an ethnicity, like a Jew and so forth. Don't fall for that. This is coming straight out of critical race theory. We're going to treat these two races differently. We saw that this morning. You see it in every way. So whites are going to be lowercase, blacks are going to be uppercase, and as your children read that in books just every day, it's going to frame their mind on this. And by the way, many critical theorists will love it. And they know what they're doing. Asymmetrical. What about the protests and riots? And several things about this. The BLM riots and others joining in. They said, the left says they were mostly peaceful. That's the way they're described. I don't know if you saw the video, but the news reporter is standing there saying, and these have really been mostly peaceful, and the town is burning behind him. Do you understand what's being created is a false reality? So there's so much I could say, but there's a false reality. You're not supposed to believe what you see. So it's mostly peaceful, although there was over $2 billion in damage. Many innocent people were murdered and killed. Many children killed. They killed cops, burned police cars, police headquarters, and other government property. The Marxists, the socialists, the progressives did not denounce them. They actually blamed society. Some of them marched with them. And I give you several quotes in the book of what they said. In January, the Trump rally, some unlawfully, breached the Capitol. It's a coup. It's an insurrection. It's pure evil. They over-dramatized it, made it far more than it was. They omitted Trump's speech, which says, I know you are going to make a peaceful march to the Capitol. His tweet that said, we have exhausted all the laws, the legal recourse, and there will be a peaceful transition of power, was deleted. By the way, they did a study and they made a comment and it said, and I'm paraphrasing, this is just off the cuff, but black racism and white racism are equally evil. They're equally evil, wrong. So they asked two groups. One of them, they said, that's a statement from Martin Luther King, which it is, by the way. The other one, they said, it's a statement by Donald Trump. The ones that they said it came from Martin Luther King, only 2% disagreed. With a Trump, 50% disagreed. It mattered who said it, see? So it's not just about the truth, it's who says it. And that was a blind study, by the way. It was just off the cuff. So the coup was an insurrection. But the FBI that investigated it, one of them said they did not confiscate any weapons. That's a heck of a coup there. Did you know conservatives denounced both? They denounced what the left did and they denounced that. And all the leaders that I know of denounced it that day. I denounced it that day. I don't denounce who's involved because I don't know all the facts, but those that were doing it, I denounced it, and others did as well. This is why this asymmetry is why you can't legitimately, well, they have the Marxists and we have the alt-right. You can't legitimately do that because we don't accept them. We reject them just like we reject the Marxists. But on the left, they don't reject the Marxist and the socialist, see? Asymmetry. Another example, the BLM versus COVID protest. When the BLM protest, that was okay. When some said they wanted to protest the harsh COVID restrictions, The left said, that will not be tolerated in this city. While the BLM was rioting in the same city. And the people who wanted to protest the harsh restrictions of COVID were primarily on the right. What about the BLM versus the COVID concern? Meaning we don't want to do anything to spread COVID. The left, they had a right to protest. So they're out there protesting and they're side by side and we're saying, what about the spread of COVID? What about spread? Well, they have a First Amendment right, you know, to protest. And then when Trump had a rally, he's a murderer. He is murdering people. He's knowingly murdering, and all his followers, they are murdering people. But they forgot the same First Amendment, the right to assemble. You see the asymmetry? So maybe they're both wrong. Maybe they're both, you know, you could do both. Maybe you shouldn't do either one. That's up to people to decide. But I'm trying to show you the asymmetry. A cop kills a person who's a lawbreaker. George Floyd, example, most recent in 2020. Another example is Ashley Babbitt. You may not know her name. When a white cop kills a black person who broke the law and is a criminal, riots break out. News covers it ad nauseum. It is everywhere. You cannot keep from finding it. It is covered on every station, every paper, every blog, everywhere. You cannot escape it. It's all over the place. There are endless pictures of the white policeman, his name. One of the wives had to divorce the husband to get away from it all. But when it is a black cop killing a white person, it's a very different story. The black Capitol police officer killed a white woman, and that would be Ashley. Did you know you can hardly find that on the internet? You can go search it yourself. You can hardly find it. Ashley Babbitt was a white woman, and she was fatally shot. She joined in the riotous breach of the Capitol on January the 6th, 2020. So she was breaking the law. And the Capitol police officer who shot her was black. And I searched, and I've actually recorded the dates that I did this. So I searched the internet on several different days trying to find this. Couldn't find it. The way that I found out that he was a black officer was that I watched a video that showed that she was a part of breaking in when the breach was happening, and I saw the hand come out with the gun. The hand was black. The gun was fired, and she died. That's how I knew it. I still don't know his name. I'm not saying you can't find it. I'm just saying it is not there. It is very difficult. And I couldn't find it on any of these days, and I still haven't found it. I do have a link to this video. LawOfficer.com, which is the only major law enforcement website and media company owned and operated by current and former law enforcement professionals and supported by media scholars and professionals. It's the only one in existence. This is what they said about it. Quote, "We have looked frantically for any media outlet anywhere that has discussed this police shooting. We have not found it," end quote. You see the asymmetry? White cop kills a black one. It's everywhere. Black one kills white. Can't find it. I actually think the shooting was justified. They did rule that the Capitol police officer shooting was justified, and I'm not debating that point. Just on what I know, it seems like it was. My point is the asymmetry. What about the asymmetry of how you deal with conservative and liberal? You censor conservatives, but not liberals. In academia, it's been going on for decades and decades, and I wrote The Death of Man in 2011, and I chronicled and documented a lot of this, but you have to understand, it wasn't starting, it had been going on. I was chronicling what had been going on up to that time, and it still continues unabated. You have to be aware of the multiple times that conservatives have tried to go on campus and been invited. They've been invited to come speak, and they had to cancel because of the riots. The left can do anything. And the right's not allowed to do anything. At the same time, they welcome Marxist sympathizers, and socialists. in anybody who is anti-Marxist, meaning they're against us. Books. If you question transgenderism, you're pulled from the shelf. They won't show it. That's already happened. But the same companies will sell Mein Kampf. They'll sell the works of Marcuse and Gramsci and Horkheimer. Speech in the virtual marketplace, and that's what social media has become. It's like the downtown square, but now it's a virtual place. Some have even called it a utility. But liberals can say basically anything, and we can prove it's false, and it just doesn't get taken down. But the conservatives, if it's false, it's taken down. It may be false, but many times false means that you have said something against social justice. There's something called censorship and pre-censorship, according to Herbert Marcuse. And he deals with this in Repressive Tolerance. So the way you would divide this is that censorship is, we're going to stop you from speaking. So you're a conservative, we're going to stop you from speaking. So we're going to not let this conservative come on campus. That's censorship. Pre-censorship is, we're going to stop the flow of information that made a person like that. We're not going to let you have access to that information where you can make up your own mind. We're going to stop that. That's pre-censorship that he talks about. So the paragraph is kind of difficult to understand, so I'm just telling you that he's talking about when this perversion happens, when this perversion that we're talking about, that this people are becoming patriotic and conservative, and they're establishing, they're supporting the way it is, and they're not allowing this Marxian revolution to happen. When that perversion happens, so here's the quote I want you to get. The efforts to counteract this dehumanization, that's what they believe it is. Remember, they're looking at everything from a communist viewpoint, must begin at the place of entrance. There where the false consciousness takes form. Now just stop for just a second. So they got to stop it where it's entering. So it's coming into your mind. You're reading this book. You're going to this class. You're listening at this church. We have to stop all that. That's the pre-censorship, to keep you from becoming the person we have to censor. And the false consciousness, what that means, you'll see this in Marxian language a lot, and they used it particularly back in the 60s. Now it's been replaced with some popular concepts like systemic racism, structural racism, but it's the same idea. And that is what they're saying is, we have a false consciousness. We can't understand. We think we're free. We think we're happy. We think we like going to work and having a job and choosing to work here or go to school, but we have a false consciousness. And the critical theorists are the ones that can destroy that and bring us to a real consciousness, which would be to like Marxism. That's what they mean by that. So it goes on. It must begin with stopping the words and images which feed the consciousness. To be sure, this is censorship, even pre-censorship. Now this has to do with commercials. He hates commercials. And he hates commercials that show something flippant and something serious at the same time. So this has to do with commercials, advertising, preaching, teaching, anything, books. Here's another quote on this pre-censorship. He says, and I quote, they would include the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements which promote aggressive politics, armament, militaries and stuff. Chauvinism, that's male leadership. Discrimination on the grounds of race and religion, or which oppose the extension of public services, Social Security, medical care, we call that health care. So any social program by the government. Aggressive policies would be Trump's America First. See, it's very hard for the average person to figure out, well, why wouldn't, I mean, the founders believe that. They risked their life for it. Why wouldn't we? Because it's an aggressive policy, and it must be stood against with everything in us, in them. You're the racist that they're talking about. You know why? Because you're a white supremacist. So we can stop your speech. We can take away your First Amendment. We can take away the Bill of Rights. We can take away your constitutional rights because you're a racist. You have aggressive policies. You support the military. They start restricting free speech of those that are accused of racism. Or if you're against social policies. So you're against health care, government health care, government this, government this. We can take away your free speech. You have no constitutional right. See, this isn't makeup stuff. This isn't some nutty person. I'm not saying everybody's read Marcuse or Gramsci or knows this stuff. I'm just saying this stuff is orderly. The means to stop all of this is undemocratic. He talks about that. Illegal riots. So when I say free speech is not valued by them, if you disagree with them, they will destroy you. You think, well, that's a little extreme, Ronnie. No, it's not. This is what they say. Watch what they do. You disagree, they'll burn your buildings down. They'll destroy this, and they'll do it on a personal level. And I've watched this on a personal level. I've been the brunt of some of it, and some of it by people who I assume are Christians. They say they are, but they've bought into it. They're woke. Let me just mention this one last thing, and I'll stop. Because defunding the police and tearing down prisons, that sounds so nutty to us. And so many people, when it came up for a vote here, well, we're just reducing the budgets and so forth. And so many Christians got involved in it and just got sucked into it, and Marxists love that. They'll take anybody's help to get to their goal. But make no mistake about it. When they say, when Black Lives Matter says, we're for defunding police, do you know what they mean? Do you know what they mean? Totally defund the police so that there are no police. That's what they mean. You say, well, that will bring anarchy. Of course it will. And that will lead to the Marxian utopia. So it makes perfect sense. They argue these things. They're against the military. Why? Because Trump said, I'll call out the National Guard. We need to destroy the military. So Marcuse says, again in this paper, this essay, he says this, but I believe there is a natural right of resistance for oppressed and overpowered minorities to use extra legal means if the legal ones have proved to be inadequate. If they, meaning the oppressed, use violence, they do not start a new chain of violence, but they try to break an established one. So what we see is there's law and order. Yes, it has their flaws. If there's a policeman that's racist, if there's a policeman who abuses his power, and there are some, find them and get rid of them. But the system is good. What they're saying is when there's a military, when there are police, it is abusive. It is murder. So we're not starting that. We're trying to stop it. I remember they're actually saying that on camera. So when they say defund the police and the military, it's not an exaggeration. They're not speaking hyperbolically. It must happen. And the way they legitimize it is they problematize everything. So you have a guy, when George Floyd was killed, and I wrote in the book, and you'll see I have a footnote, at the time of the writing, I thought it was the policeman was wrong. But I hold my final judgment until all the facts are in, and they're never in the day that it happens. Trust me. We have proof of that over and over. But from what I saw, I accepted that. Did you know there was just a unanimity among all different groups that it was an unjust killing? Now, whether the court will decide that, but I'm talking about the information we knew. It was just across the board. And yet they rioted. That doesn't make sense, does it? You see, there's an asymmetry in everything they do. You just keep watching for it. So I told my daughters, who were at the Trump rally, by the way, in January, and they tell some things that actually they saw, but it was peaceful all day and on and on and on. But they did even actually talk to some of the people who tried to breach and so forth. One was a Vietnam veteran who was not a rioter or anything, but he just felt like he had been betrayed by his government. And then there were what they call agitators. So it was a mixture of people. Some of them were Trump supporters and some were not. And so forth. But I told them, I said, you have to watch what's the most significant thing happened on January 6th is the asymmetry. It's the most significant thing that came out of that. It's how they treated the riots in the summer and how they treated that. Conservatives denounced both. They didn't. That's what you have to be watching for. We're at a serious moment. This isn't happening fortuitously. These are not random acts. They're laid out. Gramsci lays it out. Marcuse lays it out. Horkheimer lays it out. And then this morning I made the connection for you, but you can make it over and over again, where the people that are promoting this stuff, they go back to critical theory. They just don't do it in popular things. Your children in elementary school are not going to see, and Max Horkheimer of critical theory and Karl Marx developed this. It's going to be painted very beautifully, but they're still getting it. Let's pray. So Lord, the great corruption is to the gospel, adding social justice. And Lord, I know that we all think abortion is an atrocity of atrocities, murdering the innocent. And we would do everything we can to see it stopped, and yet it is not a part of the gospel. The gospel is the death, burial, and the resurrection of Christ, that he died for our sins. And whosoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. And then social justice and all of these things are results of people who have been changed by the gospel. And Lord, I pray that we as a church will not be drawn in. And when we see people drawn in or being drawn in, or in any way sympathetic, I pray that we'll, in a kind and loving way, begin talking to them, because there comes a place or the curtain falls down, and you can no longer talk to them. They will not listen. And they will call you every name in the book, and we have to be ready for that. We have to be willing to bear those titles. We have to make sure they're not true, but we have to be willing to bear them, because they will come. And Lord, we have to understand, in this, there's no disagreement. There is, if you don't agree with us, we will destroy you. And that's what they're set about now. And they will do it on a corporate level, on a level of a church, a school, individual, family, whatever relationship. So Lord, may we stand strong with those, and there are many, who are standing strong for the gospel and exposing this stuff. May we do it. We love you in Christ's name. Amen.